Good afternoon, evening, and welcome. You're listening to Beyond the Official Narrative. I'm your host, Richard Carey. Hour two of the broadcast here again on this Thursday, December 7th, 2023. We're here with Blackbird 9, continuing the themes and topics we enjoyed with Willem in the first half. And I have to say right off the start, you know, that, I mean, it's just quite a daunting topic if you're looking into, you know, the cult is the best way I would put it, which is Judaism overall. I mean, you have so many dimensions. You could look at ancient history. You could look at medieval history. You could look at more recent machinations in Europe and America, and then the current day and how it links to these current wars, the laws, the censorship, this resolution with the anti-Zionism, even is anti-Semitism, you know, a certain particular ideology of a certain type of stance of some of the people who identify as so-called Jews, of so-called Judaism, you know. But I mean, I wanted to also talk about, you know, well, what things even predate their alleged 6,000 years. You know, maybe that's a good place to start, Blackbird, because now they claim it's been around 6,000 years, right? As a people, they've existed. So, I mean, prior to that, were there some of these phallic worship religions? And the Dogon, does that predate that?
Right, and that's one of the things that when you start getting into race realism and the actual history, and you know, DNA has just opened up a whole new dimension of dating history and the move of people, and that, yes, people are genetically different than each other. They may look like each other, but they are vast difference, both physical and mental and spiritual. And so one of the things that I've really researched in my nine-layer timeline is, you know, when did Homo sapiens pop into the archaeological record? When did Neanderthal pop into the, you know, archaeological record? How did those two groups manage through the last great ice age, which I call T6, 50,000 to 22,000 BC? And, you know, once we came out of that last great ice age, how did these hunter-gatherers that followed the herds and the stationary cave dwellers, you know, how did they start interacting as the ice melted and we moved into the gold era? And eventually we had the second mini ice age. I was talking about first hour at the end of, you know, what I call the silver era, which, you know, is at 10950 BC. There was an asteroid that hit the Earth, caused massive destruction, widespread famine. You had a mini ice age, and the catastrophe, you know, basically pushed the agrarian revolution. This is when, you know, because of that, you know, developments, you started getting the city-state model. You started seeing husbandry, the domestication of animals, the domestication of honeybees, you know. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, basically we would call that now eugenics and selective breeding programs. And this was one of the things about those matriarchal fertility cult systems, is they were selective breeding, and it was a two-tiered system. You know, it was a master-slave system where women were the, you know, elite, and then the men were basically the workers, either rewarded slaves, etc., or, you know, punished slaves. And so you see this, you know, echoed in our fairy tales and, you know, our folk legends. And I, people that, if you're interested in this kind of thing, you know, Joseph Campbell's work, Manly P. Hall's work, Marie-Louise von Franz's work, Jung's work, Carl Jung's work, the Robert Graves, The White Goddess, the Golden Bough. Those are, you know, the standards of what was it like before Western civilization throughout Europe into Asia Minor, right? And so then when you see the development of these people who call themselves the Hebrews at 4000 BC, because that's where they put their creation story in Genesis, according to Usher's calculations, you see this, you know, will society. That, you know, empires are being created by men by their own hands, you know, the free will type thing. But before that, you know, I was saying first hour, you had these chance systems and these fate systems, and they were matriarchal. And there was all about the various black magics, especially the blood sacrificing and the drinking of blood, et cetera. When you have all the tales of the women that would steal the babies to keep the eternal youth, and you know, the story of Snow White, and you know, the seven dwarves. And remember, you know, the seven dwarves and the prince. You were either a breeder that's, you know, was probably ritually circumcised, right? Or you were dwarves and slaves, that you were probably castrated at an early age because that made you more, you know, workable, right? You know, easier to get along with. Yeah, so this type of thing that you know, these systems had, the Sun King system, where you were king for a year, but then at the winter solstice you were ritually sacrificed and eaten. Right. So, you know, there's just real dark side to these fertility cult systems. And, you know, the classic image of the babies being presented to Baal and Moloch, you know, it's like, OK, we're going to take the perfect babies and all the others go on the fire. Also, the system owns your baby. The temple owns everybody. And we're going to come for your children and we're going to grade and sort them into alpha, beta, gamma, deltas. Right. And so, you know, it's a very different type of system, but you see that Judaism has really incorporated those things. They just say now, instead of the women being the goddesses, now the rabbis will be the gods. And that, you know, they really have this mindset that they are going to be the gods of the planet. So one of the things I was thinking about, you know, from first hour was, you know, our original topic was, you know, from the beast, from the dragon to the beast, that very cryptic line in Revelations, at chapter 13, no less, Revelations of St. John, chapter 13, where the dragon gives his authority over all the world to the beast, right? And so throughout all of this, you know, Zabatean Francus literature, you know, they always refer to themselves as the beast. Aleister Crowley referred to himself as the beast, you know, that they are part of this beast energy that's going to bring in the new age. And so that's what I find fascinating about, you know, these, you know, early systems, is they were absolutely ruthless. You know, Mr. Wilhelm was talking about natural law, and I just think about, you know, living here on Blackjack Mountain, North Kakalaki, especially in the wintertime, you know, you realize, you know, nature is ruthless. There is no appeal to nature's laws. You know, this is the way it is. And so, you know, those early matriarchal systems, you know, they were ruthless but efficient. That's the thing, you know, they ran with great efficiency for very long periods of time. But it's interesting that throughout all of that area of Europe and the, you know, Middle East and the Levant, where this systems flourished, when they finally went down, they completely went down. They were completely destroyed. You think, how many books deal with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Ai, Jericho, you know, all of them were completely destroyed and all the records, you know, burned by fire. We will never speak of this again. And that's one of the reasons it's so hard to get good, accurate information about that period from 10,000 to 4,000 BC, is because when that there was that backlash, it just swept through like wildfire. And you think, you know, how many of these systems then passed laws about women with authority, you know, that we will never let the women do this again type of thing. And so a lot of feminists really don't want to talk about that aspect. So back to you.
Okay, so no, that helps a lot with the background of the phallic worship, and you know, that would have some predating before 4000 BC, as you mentioned. What about the Dogon? What era, time period would that?
Let me see, get my timeline here. Just happen to have my handy timeline here. And
I know I was also wanting us to get into, you seem to point out in the first hour, right around like 1100 AD, that there was a lot of change to what we now know as Judaism. You touched on in the first hour. So after that, I would like to get into that as well. Basically, right around the time of the Gregorian chant, and a little before, like the. I know I have a lot of great vinyl from the French Gothic era. You know?
Oh yeah, some incredible stuff, and yeah, you know, especially when it's tuned properly. Yeah, that's music is magic, and it's interesting that whole tune everything to 440 hertz, you know, that really, you know, damaged the power of music when it should have been at those classical tunings. But yeah, the Sumerians, looking at my timeline, like 3500 BC is when the Mesopotamian Empire really started up between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And you know, there's just so much weirdness there with like the Dogon, and then, you know, the Scythians and all that coming out of those regions, the Beaker people, you know, who were these people? What were their belief systems? And then, you know, fast forwarding to when I was talking about the Templars excavating under the Temple Mount, and yeah, that so much of the York Rite and Freemasonry is about that. The first 3 degrees are talking about the building of the first Temple of Solomon, which, of course, there's no archaeological evidence that ever existed there in Jerusalem. But, you know, the first 3 degrees of Freemasonry was all about building Solomon's temple. And every Freemason thinks that they have a sacred duty to, that's what they're working for. That's their end game, is they're going to build the temple, the new temple in Jerusalem, just like, you know, Solomon built the first temple with Hiram Abiff, right? And
wow, I had no idea that Freemasonry had some of its origins that strongly in these temples from the Torah.
Oh, yes. That's, you know, Freemasonry from the beginning to end is Judaic. Now, original Freemasonry, people like Dennis Fetcho can argue all day that there were the original, you know, gifted and talented schools where you learn skill, building skills, you know, those existed. But yeah, this thing that we call Freemasonry after 717 AD, you know, the Grand Lodge of London, that is, you know, 100% a Jewish construction, and it's all about Jewish rituals. And so the first 3 degrees is about building Solomon's temple. The York Rite is all about when the Knight Templars were formed and went to Jerusalem during the Crusades, dug underneath the Temple Mount, and one of the rituals you go through is actually drinking wine symbolized by blood from a human skull, right? So this is part of the rituals. And then you research about, you know, adrenochrome and everything, and the storyline goes that there were the original 9 knights. One was set to guard the entrance of the tunneling to keep it secret, so you had that secrecy thing going. He falls asleep. One of the squires who was interested in what was going on snuck past him, got discovered. And so the decision was they were going to execute the knight who fell asleep, and basically the rituals, basically, you know, like something you would see out of Jeffrey Epstein's adrenochrome factory, where they were going to use these newfound things about torturing to then harvest the adrenochrome from the skull to, you know, bring on that euphoria and rejuvenation, right, ritual. And so that is the foundation of that drinking the wine out of the skull, is because that first knight who fell asleep, you know, was ritually sacrificed. And then all of that came into Europe. And if you ever read the book, The Sacred Magic of Aberhell and the Mage, they actually go through, you know, these Jewish rituals of sacrificing a Goyim child. And you think, okay, these people have been thrown out of over 110 countries now, you know, and it's always the same thing, the usury traps and the child sacrifice, because this is part of these occult rituals that, you know, they've been accused of doing forever, you know. And, you know, the oldest, you know, books you can imagine talk about the same things, but they always dismiss it as it's just Jewish blood libel, right? No matter how much evidence you have, it's just a canard. We're not going to look at your evidence. So, you know, these are the types of things that were going on, you know, in these systems. And like I said, it all goes back to those early fertility cult systems where you had, you know, the wicked witch that was obsessed with remaining beautiful forever and would drink the blood of the babies. And you just, there's so many tales in our long-term collective conscious memories that show up in fairy tales and folk tales and things of this Baba Yaga type, you know, witch that was all powerful. And, you know, like the Circe in the Odyssey, you know, and he goes to the island and Circe's still queen and she has all the men emasculated by drugging them and castrating them, right? So, you know, this is the type of systems that these were, you know, developing. And, you know, suddenly that's rediscovered, brought into Europe. And you can just see how it's being implemented over the years since, you know, that, you know, event in 1126. You know, everything about World Zionism is based on this, and this idea we're going to take over the world with this ancient lore that we've rediscovered. And so that's why I always go back to, you know, the dragon giving the authority to the beast. So it's this old world system, but they're calling it the New World Order. So back to you.
Yes, and this reoccurring theme of parasitism is quite fitting, of course. The blood drinking, the energy, the Talmudic, even when you describe making more than what you have, something out of nothing, even when we mention the economics, but I mean, as far as even modern vampire lore and everything, you can see how a lot of that is influenced by what you describe, you know, and those roots to it. If we were to go even further back in time for a moment, before getting to, you know, pre-Middle Ages or around there, if we were to go even further back a bit biblically and genetically speaking, do you entertain that the Nephilim are a bit more metaphorically, you know, a different and or superior genetics to man or literally? And I mean, some would have you believe some of these elites are bloodlines of them, which is kind of implying that they're like a superior genetic to Homo sapien. And why should we give them that sort of credit when it seems more that they're a detriment than a blessing to forms of life here?
Yeah, it's very curious when you go back and start rereading Genesis, looking for bloodlines, you know, and it's like from the very beginning you have all of these, you know, you know, the story is trying to explain why people are just different. And, you know, from the very beginning, Adam, you know, in Hebrew mythology and the Haggadah, you know, Adam's first wife wasn't Eve. It was Lilith, who was an equal, who was also made from clay, but she refused to submit to Adam. So therefore, she was cast off and became a demoness of the night, who was the mother of all the hobgoblins, the vampires, the werewolves, et cetera, et cetera. And then you get into, you know, Cain and Abel and the story of the serpent and Eve, that, you know, okay, actually, you know, Cain was Eve's child with the serpent. So what were they symbolizing with the serpent people? Were this the Dogon people? Were this the, you know, this some other entity that had a reptilian nature? Or, you know, how symbolic, how literal are we getting here? But then that bloodline of Cain, you know, was not punished. You know, there was no eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, life for a life with Cain. You know, Cain killed Abel and got protected status, got this, you know, this sign of Cain put on him, that if anybody harmed Cain, there'd be a seven times revenge. Then you get to Lamech, you know, and he's just not only, you know, accepting of his role as a murderer, he's bragging about it. You know, at least Cain felt bad about, you know, murdering, you know, or getting caught anyway, his brother. But with Lamech, you know, he's like, you know, his two wives, listen to me, I have killed, you know, somebody for, you know, looking at me the wrong way, right? And 7 times 7 is the revenge of Lamech. And so these modern Maccabees, you know, that are going to Jewish summer camp, you know, they're getting fed all of this, you know, propaganda of you've got to be the proud killers because you are killing for a noble cause, you know, and just you've got to start relishing in this killing. And that was what the Zabbatean Francus were teaching. So you go back and you're like, how different are these bloodlines of, you know, what came out of the last great ice age and these people who call themselves Jews now? You know, were they even part of the Levant, or this is that, you know, this, you know, area of Caesarea there that they, you know, came from? And they, you know, throughout history they were notorious, but it's always this, they have another bloodline, there's something otherly about their blood, you know. So I think you're spot on with, you know, let's look at what the Nephilim wore. It's not just, you know, this symbolic story. There's, you know, some literal things now, and thanks to DNA we can now trace these things. So yeah, I find it fascinating.
And I mean, if that were to dovetail with just the psychological profile of these people being so different, like Dr. Kevin McDonald's modern academic work, I mean, you know, there is a twisted nature. I mean, sure, in nature we see that a lot of creatures will have adapt a certain, like even appendages or abilities to better catch prey to survive, but that's generally on a different species that they're feeding off, not their own. So and that, or of course, yeah, we're questioning if that is even the case and to what extent, but. You know, oh, certainly, yeah, the psychological profile, just there's a predatory slash parasitic sort of, and also many suggest just sociopathy gene, you know, that's common.
There really is, and it has been, you know, terrifying and fascinating at the same time to watch after 9/11 a cell very highly organized, highly financed, move into this little mountain community and basically take it over. You talk about chutzpah and bullying, you know, and it's just, and, you know, we just hear story after story of these, you know, communities that get invaded, and next thing they know, it's a completely different place. And there's a great book called Postville talking about a Hasidic group buying a meat plant and turn it into a kosher plant and just taking over the town. And this is just, you know, rural America. And they were just, you know, waging war on all those Gentiles and just enjoying it, that they were destroying anybody who got in their way. Right. And just relishing that, you know, they were doing this to the American heartland and getting away with it. Same thing up here. You know, they just think they're dancing in the street that they have come in to the Appalachian Mountain and just completely turned it into Sodom and Gomorrah up here. And they control everything and they dance about it. Right.
And yet, I forgot to open with another thing I wanted to open with. And you sort of reminded me, but it slipped in the discussion again when you mentioned Hanukkah. But all of these people's holidays are about revenge and mass killing.
Yeah, revenge that they dared, you know, look at us the wrong way. So we had to kill all of them. You know, that's the thing about, you know, if a goyim strikes a Jew, meaning insult them in any way, they have to die, their whole family, their bloodline has to die, because we can't have that kind of uppity goyim going on, right? But that is the mindset. And once you have irritated one of them, you have irritated them all. So that's why I always call them slime mold, you know, because it's just this, you know, group think, you know, strategy they have, that, you know, they're all together, but they're always the eternal innocent victims, right? You know, we're so persecuted, but if you dare challenge us, we will destroy you, you know, and we will destroy your family. So just accept the fact that we are your rulers now. And that's basically the mindset of royalty, that, you know, we run this place now, we're the bosses. We're the gods of the planet. It's just like Meyer Lansky, you know, he thought he was God. And if you know, he had the authority to kill anybody he thought needed to be killed and would get away with it because everybody's so afraid of him. But that is the mindset when you realize that Meyer Lansky was a good Jewish boy, just like Judah Maccabee, you know, upholding, you know, Jewish values. And, you know, Ben Gurion, you know, he was in the Ergun. All these guys came out of terrorist families. Michael Chertoff, his parents were Mossad, right?
and I do after the bottom of the hour break, want to get back to what 1100, 1200 era, like the kind of changes you were talking about there. But as far as the Freemason foundation. In these things, like, you know, and you mentioned different degrees for the different categories. So was there something you wanted to sum up in its contribution to their current strategy, I guess?
Well, one of the things is always, you know, this idea of they're your friend, but they are seeing you as an intelligent asset. They're going to get into your life and find out something on you they can use against you. And that is the thing. You never let somebody have power that you can't destroy. And so with Freemason systems, it's all about, you know, you are basically letting them come in and do an intelligence analysis on you and your family, you know, and then they always have something on you that they can use to destroy you. And this is why things like Jeffrey Epstein, you know, that was Unit 269 under Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak, the same guy that was most likely handling operations in the U.S. on 9/11, you know, they set up this, you know, honeypot thing for politicians and celebrities to basically say, you know, we got you blackmailed now, you've got to do what we say. And this is how they rule. So back to you.
Well, there's the break. We'll be right back for the bottom of the hour.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Do you begin to smell some funky little things going on? Let me share this story with you. It's not so much a story, it's something I wrote years ago. Read your history, people. Stock markets collapse on Friday. Bank seizures, closures, holidays take place after business hours on Friday. Do currencies or governments also collapse on Friday? Tomorrow's Friday. Will the end come on this Friday, or will the inevitable collapse hold off for a while? The next round of the worst financial crisis in 100 years is coming, people, and the government is out to make you and I pay for it. And will your savings survive a global banking wipeout? What happens when the U.S. sees hyperinflation? What if taxes soar not only for the rich? Can you survive if the stock market tanks? Look, between a stock market wipeout, waves of bank failures, soaring government spending that will lead to hyperinflation, and the destruction of the dollar's value, isn't it time that you prepare for the uncertainty which lies ahead? Protect your money now, or forever kiss it goodbye. My friends, I offer you over 6 decades' experience of hard asset ownership and knowledge. And I'm prepared to handle the smallest detail in the balanced protection of your portfolio. For as the future of uncertainty continues to blanket this nation of ours, I believe that I can offer you the privacy, safety, security, and possibly some profitability which you deserve. And so I invite you to visit SierraMontrePreciousMetals.com for further information regarding protecting your wealth. Or call me, Jeffrey Bennett, at 602-799-8214. Or by email at KettleMoraineLTD@Cox.net for private consultation. Once again, our phone number, 602-799-8214. It's almost Friday.
Here's some interesting news. Due to all the recent claims about possible nuclear wars, viruses, solar flares, and civil unrest, people are scrambling to prepare and stockpile food. But the one thing out of reach for many is an underground bunker. Until now. Because you can now have a 3D printed underground bunker in just one day. An excavator digs a hole in your backyard, and 3DBunkers.com shows up in a small truck and sets up their 3D printer under a tent completely undetected. They can print as many rooms as you want at a fraction of the cost compared to traditional metal bunkers. 3D Bunkers uses polymer concrete, which is 5 times stronger than regular cement. YouTube 3DBunkers.com and watch the video. The creators of 3D Bunkers is looking for a business partner that can help bring this technology to the world. And we need to protect our way of life without living in fear. Contact Brad at 3DBunkers.com for more details, or visit 3DBunkers.com.
They're making the last film. They say it's the best, and we all help make it. It's called The Death of the West. The kids from fame will all be there. Free Coca-Cola for you.
And we are back, folks. Beyond the official narrative here on Republic Broadcasting. Richard Carey with our guest tonight, Frederick C. Blackburn, host of the Saturday Snack Shack with Blackbird 9, and that's 6 p.m. Central on Saturdays. And I guess we'll just jump back to the timeline of Judaic developments, Blackbird, if you would, please.
All right. Well, yeah, just again, starting at 70 AD when the temple is destroyed and you have the diaspora, 135 when they're prohibited from the cities. That's the real scattering. And then 1099, you have the Priory of Zion being formed. And this is a bloodline that claims that they were the rightful bloodline, right? But they were usurped. And so you've got that revenge element that not only are they going to have to take revenge against Rome and Christianity for destroying the temple, but also against the people of France because, you know, they felt like their bloodline, the Merovingian bloodline, had been slighted, right? So then you had the Knights Templars formed in 1118 as basically the Shabbat Goyim for the Priory of Zion, the collection agency. And, you know, it's early marketing, you know, because you put a red cross on them and, you know, you can't stand against the cross. They've got the authority, right? And so it was amazing how, you know, so much of Europe immediately bowed down to the authority of these, you know, the Knights Templar, right? So this was early Edward Bernays marketing, when what they were doing was really, really dark. It was, you know, basically international banksterism early on, loan sharking, et cetera. And then 1126, when they went to Jerusalem, dug beneath the Temple Mount, they found something, but it had nothing to do with King Solomon or any of the Torah. And what they found was encrypted, coded, a symbolic type thing. They spent, you know, they're still decoding some of it, but, you know, basically as they would decode it and decipher it, they would implement it into the esoteric circles of Judaism. And always remember, in Judaism, you had the written law, and then you had the oral tradition, right? So there was the stuff you never wrote down, because if you wrote it down, people would kill you for it, right? So this became incorporated as the Talmud, the Zohar, the Kabbalah, the sacred magic of Abramel and the Mage, which specifically talks about child sacrifice, tarot cards, etc., and would be the foundation of the Zabbatean Frankist Illuminati system of the Rothschild bloodlines, right? So then we, you know, we move forward, and as they start running these operations, Philip II in 1182 was the first to throw them out. You know, this is an organized crime ring. You know, you guys need to leave France. So that was one of the early expulsions. Then in 1204, you had Montsegur, the chateau was a stronghold in the Pyrenees Mountains between Spain and France, right? And so then you had all the Albigensian crusade of trying to, you know, round up, you know, who is doing these black magic circles, you know, type of thing. Then 1215 in the UK, you have the Magna Carta, and it's interesting just how much Jewish power there is. The three articles dealing with the problem with the Jews and the Magna Carta aren't on display. When you go to see the official Magna Carta, those are omitted, you know, but they're, you know, one of the big things was, how do we deal with this Jewish crime syndicate, basically? And, you know, that despite that, you know, would just be a few years later that in 1290 that the Jews would be expelled from England, right? Then, of course, that's, you know, revenge. Every time they get thrown out, we have to have revenge. 1306, they're thrown out of France again. 1307, on October the 13th, Friday the 13th, almost every Knight Templar in France is arrested. But what's interesting with the story there is somebody got the Jew call that, you know, this was going to happen. So over half, all the inner circle and the Jewish parts of the Knights Templar and their ships and most of their treasure magically disappeared the night before. Who was left to take the fall were all the lesser brethren and people that they, the upper lot, you know, felt that they deserved it. So again, that's the revenge thing. And many people now speculate that what happened at that point was one of the things they found when they were excavating under the Temple Mount were ancient maps which showed North America, South America, et cetera. And so lots of good evidence now. When I first posited this hypothesis back around 2005, I was ridiculed strongly, but my hypothesis was the Knights Templar went on to become the Pirates of the Caribbean in the New World, right? And that the pirates were mostly homosexual Jewish men, like the Knight Templars were mostly homosexual Jewish men. And so it was no accident that when Christopher Columbus in 1492 was going to sail to the New World, he put the banners of the Knight Templars on his ship, you know, so he would not be attacked, that he knew he was going into Templar territory. So I think that's very interesting. Of course, also in 1492 is when the Jews are thrown out of Spain. One of the big developments right before this, you got the Inquisition that started in 1481, right? This is kind of the, we're getting reports of people getting everything they have taken away by, you know, loan sharks, these Jewish loan sharks, women being forced into prostitution, children being sold to settle debts, people get running up gambling debts, and children disappearing that are being sacrificed, right? So you get the Inquisition, and sure enough, they're finding all these things happen. So in 1489, rather than having any type of, you know, epiphany that, well, maybe we need to back off of this, instead, the Grand Sanhedrin issues this letter, the letter of Constantinople, basically saying, you know, for what you say, you know, make your sons merchants that they may despoil Christians of their goods. Make your sons doctors and apothecaries so they may take away Christian lives. Make your sons canons and clerics so they may destroy their churches from within. Arrange your sons to become advocates and lawyers that they will always mix themselves up in the affairs of state in order by putting Christians under you, your yoke, you may dominate the world and be avenged on them. Do not swerve this order we give you. Okay? So this is the Grand Sanhedrin telling you Jews, you know, you are now permit it to just, you know, completely wage war on the Christians because of them throwing us out of Spain in 1492, right? Yeah, this is the development. And then,
wow, yeah, no, I mean, a modern day official edict, you know, reinforcing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories.
Exactly. You know, it's like, this is the letter. This is, you know, they even, and the topper on that is during the Zionist buildup, you know, exactly 400 years later, Rothschild runs that same letter in the newspapers as a rallying cry to Zion for Zionism in the 1890s, right? You know, that, you know, we are going to have our revenge. And so Zionism from the very beginning was all about taking revenge because they were treated so poorly by these horrible Europeans, right? And so then, you know, in 1553, Pope Julius III orders the confiscation and the burning of the Jewish Talmud. You know, the Inquisition said, this is what's in it. We can't, you know, have this. You know, this is just an evil document. So they're going to seize it and burn it. And they did this in front of the Cathedral at Notre Dame, right? And one of the things when the cathedral was set on fire, they say it was a building accident, but that was revenge of the Pope burning the sacred documents of the Jews. That was religious persecution. And it's like, you know, you say Jesus is boiling in a vat of excrement and semen. You say the Blessed Virgin Mary is a whore. You say that, you know, you can rape children in this book. This is a horrible book, right? But of course, now with Jewish power the way it is, they say that they're the victims, that, you know, the Pope was burning their religious documents. It's like, well, what's in those religious documents, right? And then,
yeah, so I mean, so in the, so yeah, since then, yeah, they're still trying to defend the Talmud. Go ahead, sir.
Right. And then in 1588, after you've had, you know, several hundreds of years of this, you know, black magic systems, a rabbi in Prague develops the idea of the golem, that we're going to start creating these golems out of clay, which is basically symbolism for, you know, these are the Gentiles that you are going to bring under your power to act as your puppets, right? And of course, in the storyline, one of the things is the golem always ends up turning on the Jewish master and destroying them, right? That's part of the deal with this, the idea of the golem. But, you know, this is what they're doing with these, you know, political puppets, AIPAC and ADL and the SPLC. Yeah, they pick the people they want in power, and they completely control them just like a golem. Same thing with celebrities. You know, Hollywood is nothing but these celebrities that are in these gilded cages, right? In 1614, Jew elite Elizabeth Bathory was arrested, and she is like one of the biggest blood sacrifices people, you know, even more so than Ghislaine Maxwell's friend, Abramovich or whatever, who's this spirit cooker woman. But at Balfour's trial, the total was over 650 people that she had killed and bathed in their blood, drank in their blood, and it was all about the black magic of youth and this adrenochrome harvesting, right? And they actually used her character in one of the Diablo games, Diablo 2 from Blizzard, as the countess that you have to defeat. And that was, you know, based on a real character. And then, you know, we move into, okay, now we got the Mayflower landing in 1620. And 1626, Zabbatai Zevi is born, and he would declare himself, you know, the Jewish Messiah in 1666, the same year as the Great Fire of London that just happened to burn down all those cathedrals, all those churches, kill all those English people, and paved the way for the city of London, which became the banking center of the New World Order and the house for all the Freemasonry type things, right? Then that's in 1666, right? Wow. So they're all about those dates, 666. Hmm. Then it's after this that you have 1694, the creation of the Bank of England, which was a precursor to the Federal Reserve. So basically taking fractional reserve banking, fiat currency, and instead of just loan sharking, now you're now controlling the bank of an entire nation. And so it's interesting that that was all Jewish power, and that basically allowed them to suck all the real wealth out of England and the UK and then use that as their, you know, weapon, again, their golem against the world as far as building their empire. You know, that was all Jewish design. 1717, you had the Grand Lodge, the Freemason Lodge of England established. Then in 1726, you have Jacob Frank being born in Poland, and he would claim to be the reincarnation of Zabbatai Zevi, and he was going to cleanse the world with purification through transgression. And his whole thing was, we have to break all the laws to hasten the Messiah coming. We have to make the world so bad that the Messiah will have to come. And so this is the, you know, mentality of these people. 1737, you have the Order of the Palladium, a Luciferian club founded in Paris, and similarly the Hellfire clubs. And these were all, you know, people join, do a little sinning, and then find out that somebody was witnessing their sinning. They didn't have videotape back there like Jeffrey Epstein did, but that's what all these social clubs were. So, you know, you go do your things that you think's private, but actually we're watching, and now we control you. Then in 1743, you have Amschel Bayer changes, is born in Frankfurt, Germany, and then he would change his name to Rothschild Redshield, and he was, you know, trained as this, you know, Jewish black magician and the art of creating money out of nothing and loan sharking, right? And so in 1760, he changed his name to Rothschild. We have the Rothschild dynasty. And then in 1763, you have the first synagogue founded in America in Newport, Rhode Island, right? So you can see how the slime mold's moving in and setting up. 1770, Amschel Rothschild with Adam Weishaupt and Jacob Frank form the system of the Illuminati, of how they're going to basically go in, infiltrate all the capitals of the world, set them against each other to destroy the system. This is that lets you and them fight, and it's all about revenge, right? And then in 1775, Chabad Lubavitch is founded with their a motto of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And it's basically, you know, the wisdom to seek our revenge and bring in our new world order. Yeah, this is what it's about. It's about crime and these, you know, sin for the sake of sinning. And then, of course, on May Day, Beltane, 1776, May 1st, they formed the Illuminati with its objections of or objectives of abolishing all government, all private property, all inheritance, all national patriotism, the family, all religion, and the creation of a world government, right? And, you know, so this, you know, has set the scenes, and you can just see that, you know, Rothschild sent one of his sons to, you know, and perhaps he was in Frankfurt, Germany, sent one son to Vienna, Austria, one to London, England, one to Naples, Italy, one to Paris, France. And so when you start seeing the run-up to World War One, it was these Rothschilds putting these Rothschilds against each other with let's you and them fight to kill the best of the Gentiles, right? Same thing with World War II. The Frankfurt School was, you know, designed to try to figure out why the world didn't fall to communism after World War One, right? So the Frankfurt School was designed. Then they brought in World War II, and we have seen, you know, the creation of the Soviet Union blog, how that rose and flow, saw how China was conquered. Then we saw how they were bringing in NAFTA to the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, right, to try to make the whole world just a Jewish Soviet system that they controlled, and we would be slowly bred out, killed off, or our numbers reduced, and white people would be completely eradicated in this new world order. So, you know, like I always say, I'm against it. But, you know, you try to tell people about it, and they just tell you your crazy conspiracy theories. And it's interesting, in 1785, the Bavarian authorities raided the home of an Illuminati member, and they discovered the documents, and they start trying to warn everybody about it. But, you know, that was censored by the already Jewish-controlled media, that, you know, these kings were trying to warn each other that they're coming for us. And they had already seen so much power that they were able to just dismiss it as, you know, more blood libel against the Jews, right? So, yeah, this is the history of these people. So when you start putting these dots together, and, you know, so suddenly you see where the World Zionist Congress, Theodore Herzl, you know, where these guys were coming from when they said, we're going to set up a series of war to get our Israel back, and then we're going to break every nation under our, you know, whip. And that's, you know, what their objectives are in this, and they're ruthless about it. And, you know, they're being exposed. And the question is, how is it going to play out? You know, so what's your take on it so far?
I just wanted to say this is an amazing broadcast you've given us here for the archive, just on a historical level. You know, I'm definitely going to make a special note and bookmark and download this one, you know, for future reference. I'm sure a lot of listeners would agree. And I there's a caller who's been patiently in the wings, and I, you know, I'd love to hear what he has to say. Joe in Florida. Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Richard. Hey, Mike Burton. No, I'm almost hesitating to interrupt this master class from Blackbird 9. Some people call him BB9. I call him BBB9. Brilliant Blackbird 9.
You're too kind.
It's a great master class, and I appreciate it too. It's a fulfillment of when I was hoping, when you get the longer format, Richard, to do this, because it requires, you know, requires this. But it's been amazing just to listen. I want to say one thing. Oh, you were speaking about the Jewish civilization about 6,000 years old. So Richard and Blackburn, tell me. So the Jewish civilization is about 6,000 years old. And the Chinese civilization is about 5,000 years old. Tell me, how did the Jews live for 1,000 years without Chinese food? Let on top. A little bit of levity never hurts. But I do want to say I really appreciate, Blackbird, you're going through that. And I agree with a lot of it. It's not everything. One of the things that I think was important, it's a little different from what Willem was talking, because I think he's a bit of a whatever. I don't know that he has any spiritual understanding. And that is, I actually believe, so I identify as a traditional Catholic. And traditional means that, you know, up until 1960, this is kind of what the church taught historically. And that is, so I think actually Jews really do, they worship a god, small g, and I do think it's Moloch or Baal, but most likely Moloch. And it's a shocking thing to say, Ethan. Most people don't want to be aware of it. But if you look at their behavior, that's the proof, right? Okay, because they really don't. A lot of Christians, very deluded Christians, Catholics and other Christians, are under the really shockingly stupid understanding that somehow we worship the same God as them. No, it's very clear throughout history that they do worship what's basically a demon, really. Okay, Moloch is a demon. It's about the child sacrifice. A lot of this, you know, I've learned also from the great Dr. E. Michael Jones, and Bishop Richard Williamson, too, is another one. What I wanted to say, we're bringing it up to speed about this war that's going on now, which is, it could be World War III, but I want to get your reaction. So to me, it's interesting because if you remember when this conflict started, you know, what they're claiming now is, Hamas initiated the attack. It's very similar to what happened in Russia and Ukraine, where they now pretend that it was Russia that initiated it. We know it's obvious that it's a Jewish war against Russia, and that they initiated.
Let's give Blackbird a moment to respond to that.
Bibi Netanyahu says that, you know, October 7th was his 9/11. I actually agreed with him for once, because it was just as synthetic as the false flag operation of 9/11. You know, Hamas was a creation of Israeli intelligence. You know, that was their goal to, you know, have this demonized radical terrorist group so they could justify going in and cleaning house. You know, made for Hollywood, you know, thing on October 7th, you know, just gave them the media, you know, bloody shirt to go in and carry out the Odin Yenin plan, get rid of Gaza. And so that's what we're seeing is, you know, this is genocide.
Exactly. And I just say real quickly is that, but it's important to understand, in April of this year, the IDF and the satanic Netanyahu and his thugs actually allowed these crazed settlers, so-called settlers, they're thugs, to go into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the IDF and these settlers beat up Muslims who are worshiping during Ramadan services in Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the Al-Aqsa flood from Hamas is a response to that attack, which I believe is the signaling of their attempt. Even tonight, they're attempting to try and get into the temple, into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You know, so it's a great analysis. Amazing show tonight, as usual, Richard. But you know, this is definitely one for the archives. We should put it on a classic. Is that what I would call it? Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Joe. You're spot on.
Yeah, it really was a pleasure and an honor. Yeah, I totally second that. Thank you, Blackbird. Have a great night.
Thank you so much for having me on. Everybody have a good night.
And folks, go to republicbroadcasting.org. Click on that donate page so that we will speak again soon. And until then, transcend the construct. Regards.
Tejibo Tea Club's original Pure Pouty Arco Super Tea helps build red corpuscles in the blood, which carry oxygen to our organs and cells. Our organs and cells need oxygen to regenerate themselves. The immune system needs oxygen to develop, and cancer dies in oxygen. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit drinksupertea.com. The first word is drink, spelled D-R-I-N-K, then the word super, then the word tea. The complete website is drinksupertea.com. or call us at 818-965-9113, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-965-9113. DrinkSuperTea.com.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.